and welcome back to episode 3 of the Queer Kahani Podcast, a quirky and curious podcast of bite-sized queer stories told in an interactive interview format. I'm your host, Sue Mutasib, and in this third episode, we'll be talking with Sophia Iannicelli, Executive Director of the Pan Eros Foundation and the Seattle Erotic Art Festival, often abbreviated as SEAF. Today, we'll be talking about the queer side of SEAF. As always, more information about this episode and the podcast is at our website, queerkahani.com, where you can find all the links we mentioned in this episode, as well as information on how to submit your own story. With that, let's start the show. So welcome, Sophia.
Hello, Subi. How are you tonight?
I am very, very good. And I'm so glad that you took the time to speak with us today. Really appreciate it.
I'm so very excited to talk with you.
So why don't we start with a little bit with even those affiliations that we were talking about. So you're director of the Pan Eros Foundation and of the Seattle Erotic Art Festival. How do those two relate to each other? What are they all about?
So that's a great question. The Pan Eros Foundation is the umbrella organization of the Seattle Erotic Art Festival and other programs that we have, mm-hmm. like the Consent Academy. And our mission is to celebrate and cultivate consent and sexuality for all. And in doing that, the Seattle Erotic Art Festival expands upon and supports that mission by creating a space that is that supports the creation, the enjoyment, and the purchase of erotic art. And by doing that, what we're hoping will happen within the Seattle Erotic Art Festival is that when somebody makes erotic art, it's an act of activism in the world. You know, that's actually going against our societal ideals that sexuality is something that we can't talk about.
Right. That has to be hidden away. Yeah.
Exactly. And the same thing for going and enjoying it. Two of the biggest goals that I have for the Seattle Erotic Art Festival mm-hmm. is that when somebody comes, no matter who they are, that they come into the festival and that they will see at least one piece of art that represents themselves, either maybe by the way people look in the art or things that are depicted or orientations, different genders, different body types. It's really important to me that we really try to cast as broad of an answer as possible to the question of what is erotic. So that's one really important thing there, is that people can see themselves reflected back to them. And then my other goal is that when you walk into the art festival, you'll see a piece of art that makes you go, oh, I get it. I mean, I'm not into it, but I get why somebody else is into it. Now I understand.
Yeah.
Because when we can do that, It expands our definition of us and makes our world more accepting, because the more we understand that we're all humans and we're all in this together, the better we can make the world. I mean, because let's face it, otherwise we have to wait for an alien invasion for us to realize that we're all one big us. And I'm not sure I even trust us to do that.
So I love that. And I particularly love that you opened everything you said with consent. And I think that's really amazing. Could you talk more about like that? And because I mean, it's clearly very central and important to what you're doing. And I'd love to hear more about your thinking and framing on that.
Oh, most definitely. So one of the things that we did in, I want to say 2015 it would have been late 2015, maybe even early 2016. We had some incidents come up in our education program. We also support relationship and intimate and consent education as well through the foundation.
Oh, wow.
And we had some instances come up and we realized, wow, we really need more than just a code of conduct. Like we really need to nail down what consent means and how to go about getting it, to create a way for all of our volunteers and all of our participants to understand what everybody's getting into. Yeah. And the more we looked at the question, we realized that that it wasn't just making a policy. Like there's a lot of change that needs to happen in the world. And when one of my board members was really taking on the task of creating what became the Consent Academy, one of my big directives that I gave to her was, it has to be focusing on teaching people not to rape people, not how not to get raped.
Yeah.
Because, and that's like so important in making that one shift. And she took me to my word, and I am so incredibly proud of what they've put together at the Consent Academy. And really it all comes down to every time we have an interaction with somebody, the more we recognize their autonomy in the world and ask for their consent, even in subtle nonverbal ways to continue our non-sexual interactions, that makes the world a better place, because when I respect you, you feel better about yourself. You're able to feel safer advocating for yourself. Yeah, and then that makes our interactions much more pleasant for both of us, because being given a boundary is an absolute gift.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, awesome. This is where I get to be. And I know that you're going to be okay if this is the way I, you know, and it creates a sense of trust between both ways, that I think is really valuable. We've had some really amazing, ways that we've like, I'm just going to say it. We sneak consent in all over the place.
That's great.
Whenever we're doing our event, and we talk a lot with our volunteers about even the people who take ticket takers, you know, it's like showing that small little bits of, oh, you're having trouble with your ticket. May I touch your phone? Mm-hmm. You know, and able to like help somebody get their ticket scanned properly.
Yeah,
just little tiny things. Although I had one really fabulous volunteer, she was offering, optional pat downs, after people got their ticket scanned, and they would, you know, come through and they'd get their little wristband, and she's like, and would you like a complimentary pat down?
That's so great.
Which was about the time that when everybody was getting all upset about the Rapiscan, and all that stuff, and the TSA and at the airport. Yep. So it was kind of her lighthearted way of like, you know, this could be all good and fun and games if we're all into it.
Yeah. And that's what, so there's two things I love about this. One is that we're starting a conversation about SEAF with a conversation about consent, which in itself is wonderful. But I think that it is such a, instantly, I feel like it's such a clear differentiator to kind of come in and say that, like, you know, you're being so consent forward and so consent centric for what is, you know, sure to be a charged event. And that is so different from so much of what we see in what, you know, most people ever encounter in terms of erotic art, you know, in their daily lives.
Very true. And that, and also you touched on something really important there when you said coming into a charged event, is that not only is it charged in the sense that you described about how, our culture isn't really good about, having an open conversations about sexuality, but also with art. And this is I have a controversial opinion on this. Hopefully it goes well.
Opinions.
Is that you can't consent to art.
Mm.
There is no way that I can prepare anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot give any cuts. I can't give enough or appropriate or helpful trigger or content warnings for people.
Right.
So all I can do is say it's in the name. It's erotic. And so many different things are found erotic. I've been working on this for 4 years now of trying to create a statement about you might see problematic art.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And the most trickiest thing about it is that unless it's illegal for me to show it,
right,
I'm only not going to show it if the jury didn't want it in there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's one of those things where what I see in a piece of art is automatically going to be different than somebody else because we have different lived experiences. You know, I'm, you know, someone who grew up with brown skin, and I have relatives that died in the Holocaust, and the way I see the world is going to be different than somebody who, you know, their family immigrated here from Sweden,
right,
you know, five generations ago, and they've lived in Seattle the whole time, you know, like, it's just going to be different.
It's so true. Yeah, I always describe art as a mirror. You know, in which we see ourselves through the distortions, you know, and the lenses that the artist is creating. you know, we see a picture of ourselves, and that can be very disturbing, right. or it can be very, you know, uplifting. It very much depends on the combination of the art, the artist, and the observer, and you can't predict what's going to happen in that interaction.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's the exciting thing about art, but it does take a lot of bravery. We very much want to create a safer space at SEAF, in the sense that we want people to feel safe physically inside the building, and we want them to feel comfortable being their authentic selves inside the space. We also are asking people to be brave, in that they're going to see things that might be uncomfortable for them. One of my favorite stories about bravery is that, and this is a secondhand story, so I apologize for that. And so I'm going to keep details really, really vague. But one of the people who worked on SEAF invited one of his coworkers. It's like, hey, you should come check out this really cool thing that I work on. Yeah. Didn't really know the guy that well at all. The guy was married to a woman, and they came to the festival. They only stayed 15 minutes. They decided it wasn't for them. But for the rest of the evening, they had really interesting conversations between themselves about sexuality and what it meant to each of them in their marriage.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that to me is one of the biggest success stories. They were brave and went and did something, decided it wasn't for them, but they still really got something really valuable out of it for themselves. And you know, this person told the person who worked on SEAF, we're really glad we went. We'll never go again. But you know, it was a really interesting night for us, and we had some amazing conversations we'd never had before.
That's pretty incredible. I mean, like, as an artist, I always feel like the things that I most want in terms of my audiences, I'd love to be a fly on the wall when they're reacting to my art. I want to understand what it evoked in them, you know, and to even get that story secondhand must feel, you know, really wonderful for you to kind of feel like, you know, you really changed people's minds. Like, you had them feel a whole new thing because of something you created, which is incredible. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's so important. And then my other favorite is someone who said, you know, coming to SEAF the first time was the first time that I went out in public socially as a woman. And it was such a big deal for me for people to not bat an eye about, you know, hearing that I had a very feminine name. And it was such a big deal that everybody used my pronouns correctly. And, you know, and I got to see art that was reflective of me. I got to see other trans bodies, and I got to see trans feminine people who, you know, were depictions that I found pleasant. And not all of them, unfortunately, but, you know, can't please everybody. That's my other like really big success story, where it's like, awesome. This person was so brave and was like, I want to go be myself, and I want to go be comfortable. And they took a risk going somewhere that they'd never been before. And, you know, we beat it into our volunteers.
That's wonderful.
About how important it is. And luckily that's kind of an easy thing, because most of all of our volunteers are from either the queer community, or they're from the leather community, or they're from the kink community, or they're from the swinger community. So they're already a part of a culture where they understand how important it is to be open and accepting, because you never know who you're going to offend if you say, I hate orange.
Right. Yeah. No, this is great. And this is actually getting to the core of, you know, what inspired this episode, kind of the queer side of SEAF. But before we get there, you know, as the director of SEAF, I'd love to get your take on, you know, what the high level goals that you see as for the event, like, what do you think of as like the high level goals for SEAF?
Probably the highest goal for SEAF is to create a better sense of us in the world. And I think that one of the best ways that we can do that is to help create understanding, because if one of the scariest things about erotic art is, if I like a piece of erotic art, then that will tell people that that's what I'm into. Is a big fear that a lot of people have about looking at erotic art, is that there's that fear of, what does it say about them if they find something appealing, or if they respond positively to it. And so I really want to set the stage, so to speak, for the whole festival so that when you come into the festival, you're invited to look at things that are not your cup of tea, as
right.
it were.
Right.
And to be able to look at it and go, oh, okay, I get why somebody would enjoy that. It's not my thing, but right. I get it now. And then that creates more understanding between people, because now the next time they meet somebody who says, I like to wear latex clothes, they're like, oh, I saw that performance where the people were like rubbing the latex, the like lubricant on the latex people. And it looks so sensual. And I can, super like, yeah, no wonder you like that.
Yeah.
You know, that is like, that is probably one of the things that I say most often is like, of course you like that piece of art. It's amazing, isn't it? Because there's always an element of joy that like when a piece of art is done well, there's some kind of reveling that's happening that you can see. And I think that that kind of joy is a really great way to teach people how other people love and how other people live their lives.
Interesting. So you feel that like when people can see somebody else having joy in an experience, even one that they don't feel strongly connected to, it increases their empathy for what that experience is like and why that is an important part of this wide world of, you know, eroticism that exists out there.
Yep. That's why places like kink.com always do those little exit interviews where the person was like, oh my God. And then that was so great when they did the thing. And you're like, I watched that. It was horrible. You look like you were having a terrible time. But yes, I totally agree that joy is one of those really core emotions that we can all connect with. And when you're enjoying something and I can tell that you're enjoying it, then I'm going to be like, oh, this is a good thing because you're enjoying it. And sometimes we need to teach each other to what enjoyment means. So like, you know, like I'm in the kink community. So there's a lot of like, okay, well, when you do the spanking and I start like wiggling and trying to get away, that's good. Keep going. Don't stop the spanking or I'll be sad. So there's sometimes the joy isn't easily recognizable, kind of like, you know, if somebody were to speak, you know, Arabic to me, I won't know what the word joy means.
Yeah.
But if they say it in a joyful tone, I can pick up on that.
Right.
And so I think a lot of it is just teaching each other our joy language.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I really like that. I wonder, like, because I can imagine a spectrum of experiences, some of which where you can, as you were saying, somebody might be clearly really enjoying themselves and you're seeing that directly. There might be others that are more complicated where there's nuance to the interaction and maybe the person is acting in a certain way, even though they're feeling a lot of joy. And then like the exit interview, like you said, or something like that is important. Like, so are there things that you can do to kind of help translate those experiences for people to help them see that aspect?
Yes, we have. So one of the big things that I'm super proud of is that we have art docents, and those are people who go around and give art talks and answer questions about the art. And so the art docents are kind of like they're the bridgers. They're the people that, that are resources, so that if you're like, I don't get this thing, and why do you have it here? Because that looks dangerous, and why would you ever like encourage people to do that?
Yeah.
And then it could be like, and then what we do is we give our docents access to the artists. We have like a special. It's actually way better now that it's virtual. I know things were able to be virtual before the pandemic, but you know, some of us were like, oh, now we have this new tool that we didn't know existed. And so we always have an opportunity for our artists to share their creation stories with our art docents, so that the docents can pass on that information. And it's twofold. One hand, it makes it easier to sell art because it helps create. It helps people build connections with the art, so that the more of a relationship they feel with a piece of art, the more of a chance they're all to buy it. Their lives are enriched. My artists get paid. It's a beautiful thing. But also, it's so that we can give people context. And context is so important. So just the fact that things are in the art festival already give people the context that something about this is sexy.
Right.
But because we do have such a really broad idea of what the art festival considers is erotic, like we go from abstract to parts into parts. And when there's something there that is speaking to somebody's identity and gender and orientation, when and there are no sexual acts taking place,
right,
that can sometimes be a hard thing for people to parse a little bit.
Right.
You know, the people who... the people who are in that demographic, they'll recognize themselves, right. But everybody else will be kind of like, what's this? What's going on? I don't understand this. We always have something with like leather or boot blacking in the festival. And there's always people that are like, why is that person licking that boot? And then somebody else will be like, that is the sexiest picture I've ever seen. They're really licking it. They're not just pretending. That's so authentic. I must have it. and so the docents can be, they can talk about it. They're like, there are people out there that fetishize leather to the point where the smell of it, the taste of it is really a turn on for them. So while their genitals may not be involved, this is a sex act for this person.
And is that, and are, so are the docents, this is fascinating. I love that, that it's almost like a, you know, like a, you know, I think of the audio guides that you have at some museum where you're walking around, but these are live humans who are doing this translation for you. So how does it work? Like, do they actually like, are they there speaking while like an event is ongoing? Are they wandering around answering questions for people? How does it work?
So we have, there are a couple of different ways. We have docents where they're just there available sitting at the table to answer questions and sell art. And they're also wandering around, but they also give tours on a regular basis. So we have about one tour an hour. Sometimes in busier parts of the afternoon, we'll have more than that. I also usually invite a fair number of artists to come and talk in the place of a docent. On the art tours, which can be a lot of fun because every now and then you'll get artists who only want to talk about their art and their creative process, and that's great. Mm-hmm. But then other times you'll get artists who are like, if I had $25,000, this is what I would buy at Sieve. Or what's even better, one of the best art tours we ever had was where one of my masters of erotic art, she was like, I don't want to talk about my art. I mean, if you have questions, I'll answer it to you. I think about my art all the time, but there's art down here that I don't understand. And we're going to go on a tour and you're going to help me understand this.
Oh, wow.
And she had a conversation with people about like, how do we handle it when we don't know what a piece of art is about?
Yeah.
And that to me was like one of the most beautiful things about it, of like people talking about something that they knew was sexual, but they didn't know exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out what made it sexual was so fabulous, because there was the sense of curiosity and of helping another person understand.
Yeah.
Was really cool.
It seems like there's also a lot of really interesting potential for artists to meet each other and collaborate, because you have so many different art forms represented, from literature to video to performance, you know, to visual art. It seems like, you know, a really wonderful opportunity for folks from, you know, different art walks of life to come and collaborate potentially.
Yes. And that's something that makes me really excited about. In the earlier days of SIEF, there was a lot of people who would talk shop the whole weekend long and get ideas for the next thing that they were going to work on over the year to be able to submit for next year. Like, there was definitely this very collegial supporting of each other as artists, and their development was a real big thing. And then we have another thing that happens where we really encourage cross-pollination. So have you ever heard the word ekphractic?
I have not.
I think I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it's a type of art that is in response to another art. And so we have all the people who our literary artists who get published in the anthology. They're invited to do this. And then we have a few other people who have been working on this over the years, but they do what we call the Writer's Wanderlust art tour. And what we do is we give access to the visual art to those artists to write poems about the visual art. And then what they do is each day of the festival, they have one art tour where they go around and they have a whole bunch of poets or people who do like very short prose, you know, like, you know, things that are only take 2 minutes, 3 minutes to speak or to recite. And they go around and do an art tour where they do a poem about a piece of art that's on the exhibition walls. And so that's just something that has been absolutely wonderful for that kind of collaboration to happen. We've had performances before where the performers also get to see the art that was accepted. And then they go and they do a pop-up performance in front of the piece of art that inspired, you know, what they did. So, I mean, that's something that I really want to, like, I want to create fertile ground for people to be able to do, to make more art. Like, the best thing at all is, like, if something happened on the life drawing at SIEF and somebody took that drawing and then used it to create a painting or a sculpture or something else, would just, like, you know, my head might pop off. I would be so happy.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I mean, as a writer, that sounds very appealing to me because, like, it's definitely like seeing, you know, whatever I see in the world, like, you know, inspires me and makes me think about stories and like that, you know, absolutely, like, you know, art that is created to evoke emotions would absolutely be inspiring in that way. So making, so kind of like you're already, by virtue of making the event, you're already creating this fertile ground for that to happen, but you're adding fertilizer to it too. Like you're really
or like here, like have some rose food. Do you need more water?
Yeah,
do you need some bark on the ground to keep the heat in?
That's wonderful. So I want to go back a little bit to kind of what the original impetus for this episode was, though, you know, from a lot of what you've said, I think, you know, the answers are becoming very clear. So what had happened is, you know, I've been to SIEF a number of times, I think almost every year that it's happened, but a lot of my friends, a lot of my queer friends have not. And when I told people that I was submitting some stories to SIEF, the response of some queer folks was that, like, oh, well, you see for me, like, you know, I thought that's just some kind of, you know, cis heteronormative kind of event. And I was trying to tell them, no, that's not the case at all. But maybe I should have an episode about this. Maybe I should tell people about what's actually going on. So you had some funny reactions when I told you that initially. And I'd love to hear what you'd say to people who have that kind of a question.
I'd just like to say that I am so incredibly honored that we have become such an institution that people assume that we must be a cis heteronormative organization to have succeeded.
Part of the systems of power, surely.
Right.
Surely this is heteronormative.
Yeah. So our the person who came up with the idea for SIEF, his name is Jim Duval, and he identifies as a straight cis man, and he very quickly he was at a drawing event that was specifically geared towards the kink community, and it was two people that were dressed up in their leather and with their writing crops and their and they were basically posing in scene, so to speak, like, you know, like, okay, we're going to pretend like we're flogging so you can draw people that are flogging somebody, a person who's flogging somebody else.
Yep.
And so he was talking, going, this is really good art that all these people are drawing. What, like, we got to get an art show or something happening. Yeah. And the artists were like, oh no, I can't ever show, like, galleries won't show any of my sexier art. Like, if it's not just a naked person standing there,
right,
nobody will show it. And so he was like, we should do a thing. And so he started to gather up a group of people, and very quickly it started devolving into who was going to arguing about who was going to design the t-shirt. And Anna Hurwitz showed up, who said, you should have an agenda. I wrote one. And Jim was like, fabulous. Will you please take over? Nice. And so that was, so that's when a straight man turned over the development of the organization to a lesbian. And she gathered up a whole bunch of other people, mostly other lesbians. You know, there were a few gay men that were involved too. And then, a few straight people jumped in, a bunch of bi people jumped in. This was, this was 20 years ago. So I don't think we were using PAN yet. Uh-huh. But it was definitely a pretty, there was three gay women and a bisexual woman who were the heads of state, as it were. And then from there, when I got involved, it was becoming much more of a fluid mix of things. And nowadays, almost everybody is some flavor of bisexual, pansexual, or some kind of queer. We have a couple of straight people, I think.
Token representation.
Like. Kind of, yeah. And and if it's funny, I was talking with one of the artists who does the life drawing, and I told him about this, and he was like, well, some of my nicest friends are straight people. They're great. But he's like, yeah, I'm not really sure they count as straight, but they say they're straight. And that's actually represents a bunch of people on stage.
It is really interesting to me. I mean, this has been my experience during my life because I feel like I don't know if this is true for everyone, but I kind of feel as you were talking about, as you gain empathy for the different forms of eroticism, when you experience other people's joy, either personally or secondhand, it's hard to not start expanding your definition of what you personally are interested in being involved in as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating. And also, I love people's definitions and how it seems to me, and this is very not scientific at all, but it very much seems to me that usually when people are talking about their orientation, they're talking about who they're romantic with and who they have relationships with.
Right, right.
Yeah, because talking about our founder, he identifies as a straight man, but he does kink with other male-bodied people and non-binary people and has no problem with that.
Yeah.
But he only dates people that identify as women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you call yourself straight, but you don't. Mm-hmm. You've touched an awful lot of penises, there, guy.
Yeah, and there's so many dimensions. I mean, this is something that I talk about in my book. Like, there's so many different dimensions. There's kind of there's who you're attracted to or have romantic partnerships with, certainly. But there's mm-hmm. how you express your gender, what gender you feel most associated with. Like, you can feel very associated with one gender, but dress completely like a different one. Mm-hmm. You can be attracted to yet another one. You can be born as, yet something else. Like, all of those things are, there's so many different dimensions to it.
And, right. And, it makes life so juicy and so complicated.
Yeah. And I think that the mission of kind of expanding people's experience to include more of those dimensions is just really amazing. So I want to go back to something that you touched on, which I really liked. I mean, you were saying it jokingly, but that, CIFA is this institution now. It has substantial credibility. People know about it. People hear about it. And one of the things I find really inspiring and wonderful about CIFA is that you are lifting erotic art to the stage of public art. Like you were saying, that the founder wanted to have an event like this, galleries would show it, and you wanted to bring it to that. And I'd love to hear more about, how that process has been. Like, what are the challenges you've faced, and what are the successes that you've seen over the time of doing that?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that, because one of the most fascinating things about it has been that traversing of being, you know, if you remember the very first thief that was in the basement of Town Hall and on opening night was completely like people around the block trying to get in because the organizers had no idea that anybody but a few of their friends were going to come.
Yeah.
And now being in the Seattle Center where we have, I know city government, it works slow and it's labyrinthine, but the people at the city who work with us are an absolute joy to work with. They take such good care of us. They don't fight, but like, you know, I hear all the time of like, oh, I saw you up on the schedule and I made sure to, you know, get my shift so that I could come, you know, be here at the show. And so that's the really interesting thing is that we are, you know, at this point where the city government is assisting us in this endeavor. And actually, this is like probably the best place for us to stay because it gives us a sense of credibility. Yeah. It makes it a little bit safer because it's like, oh, it's the Seattle Center. You know, it's the Seattle Center wouldn't let something terribly depraved happening, which the number of people who work in city government who like to come to our event, not as a work job is like everybody's definitions are different.
Yeah.
And so I would have to say that that was probably one of the biggest things that I learned was just the venue actually reduced a lot of our resistance in the world.
Interesting.
And now we've gotten to the point now where when people hear about it, it's the first thing that they, you know, they go one of two ways and like kind of lets me know who I'm dealing with. And one is like, is that naked? So it's like all naked art. Like, can you be naked there?
Yeah.
Or there's the, oh, really? You have it at the Seattle Center? How interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's so interesting how it's like this, you know, it's like this automatic, it must be okay if they're letting you have it in a city building. So that was a really strange thing about that made our life easier.
It's really interesting. Yeah.
And then the other things about trying to get people to understand that it's like, no, this art is valuable. This is, I feel like teaching people that art that reflects, our erotic lives is terribly important because who we love is a huge part of who we are because humans are made up of our interactions with everybody else. Absolutely. And so who we choose to, who we are, who we love. And actually, I don't believe we get to choose who we love. I mean that I've known too many people who are like, yeah, I guess I'm gay now. I fell in love with them. I'm gay now, I guess. I didn't mean to.
I've heard people utter these words. I know of what you speak.
Yeah, sometimes we don't get a choice of who we love.
Yeah.
And so having art that can reflect such a core part of who we are is so important to be able to have a place where something that is so core to our personalities and to who we are as humans and have that be accepted, I think is vital for people's sense of wholeness and healthiness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so being able to get people to understand that even if it is, you know, I joke about how we have all forms of erotic art from abstract to parts into parts, and people giggle when I say parts into parts, but it's like, you know, even that's art.
Yeah.
You know, yes, it can be done poorly and you won't see that at the festival.
Right.
You know, I don't, and sometimes you look at it and you're like, I can't tell any story there, but wow, is it well lit? And you know what? That is the artistic statement. Sometimes artistic statement is a beautiful person lying in the forest on the floor is beautiful, is an artistic statement. Yeah. It might not be an interesting one to me, but it's still an artistic statement. And, you know, why not? We've had plenty of other, like, beautiful person stands in artist studio with fabric draped over their shoulder is beautiful. Yeah, that's an artist statement too.
So speaking of that, so that's a great segue because the next question I wanted to ask was, What has the reaction of the more traditional art community in Seattle or nationally been? Like, do you feel like there's been more of a conversation as your event has grown in stature and influence with the other parts of the Seattle art community?
You know, this is where I'm going to show my lack of education and lack of connections in the traditional art community, is that I go out and I make forays. So I used to be an artist model, and that's actually how I found the very first thief, is that I found the call for art in 2002. Okay. And you know, I'm like, oh, hey, there's a thing for yay. So I don't have a lot of connections in the art community except for, and I saw the people who were running the festival before me really do their best to court the traditional arts community galleries and artists. And there was usually pretty good reception from artists who would be like, oh, I could make something for that, or I do have stuff like that that I've never shown in public before. You know, so like there's always that.
That's great.
But there has been a very steady small percentage of artists who are like, I don't do art like that. I just don't. I'm not going to make something special for you. And you know, and there's some things that are really funny, like Ryan Henry Ward, who does all the murals around Seattle.
I know him,
Yeah, he started out as an erotic artist, and he just, you know, he just, Oh, he was in Seif early on, and I didn't know it. And so one time he was like, why doesn't Seif love me? That you never invite me. And I'm like, I didn't know. Come.
So, wow, that's incredible.
So what was that, 2014 or 2015? I can't remember which year it was. But basically he did an installation where he painted this fabulous, like, little gnomes and fairies running around fucking each other, 16 feet wide by 8 feet tall. And he did it on, he started on the artist reception on Thursday night, and then he came back on Friday, and worked on it during the day and through the evening for our opening gala, so that by the end of the night, he was all done. And we had this fabulous romping, you know, fucking fairies, scene as people first walked in the door, as, you know, that Henry did. So that was really kind of a fun thing to where he was like, oh yeah, this is like what I'm, this is what I like to do.
That's incredible. So that's from the artist perspective, but that sounds like a really positive response. Like, what about the venues? Like, have you seen the venues becoming more accepting over time for taking, you know, taking art from Seif and showing it in galleries or things like that?
That one I have not seen happen as much at all. I have not courted it either. So that's something that is one of my big dreams. Like, I would, we had like a big, like, reorganization visioning, thing in, 2010. And actually we do that pretty regularly, about every 3 to 4 years, just to see like, hey, are we doing what we say we are doing, or have we grown and changed? And the last time we had that really big visioning a meeting, there were a bunch of us that on this kind of steering committee who were talking. And it was one of the things that the facilitator asked was, what are your goals? And one of the goals was, I want it to be Seif Week in Seattle. I want everybody to schedule their erotic art exhibitions in their gallery in April, because Seif is in April. And that was my predecessor, Alina Gabash. That was her one. And, and like my personal goal for Seif is for, 1 in 3 galleries in America to have, basically like an erotic art collection, something that they do every year, or something that they have a room in the back, or like, I want it to be so commonplace.
Or room in the front. Why not?
Right. Or I say room in the front. That's what we have at Gallery Errata. We Seif now has its like own gallery that we round.
I was going to say that, like, I mean, hopefully, like, you know, I mean, I think some of maybe understanding the fundamentals of the event, like you're talking about today, is part of the story that hopefully we can get some of those gallery owners to listen to. Cause I think it's, you know, the you know, I think a lot of what you talked about how, you know, both about how art evokes these powerful emotions in people and creates strong reactions, which is the kind of thing we want powerful art to do, and celebration of joy, and then kind of expanding people's worldviews. Like, there's so much there of, like, you know, because art is a verb, right? Like, we it's active, it does things, it doesn't just sit on the wall. Like, we don't do art to make something that balances the colors of your couch. Like,
oh, I so disapprove of that.
We make art to create emotion, to create reactions, you know, and this is exactly the kind of impact that you're talking about for your festival, which I think is so important.
Yeah, people ask me all the time, they're like, are you an artist? And I'm like, well, yeah, kind of. Like, I put all my creative energy into, like, creating a really juicy space for people's art to be showcased, you know, because it's like you have to put people in a position to be ready for art. Like, it's like you can so much more easier be open to whatever mysteries that you might find when you see in that artistic mirror if you're in a space that makes you feel, you know, like anything is possible, and that it's going to be exciting and fun to discover new things, not scary.
Absolutely. And it's because you've created that environment, right? Like, even the stories that you told in the beginning, that, like, oh, here's this person who left after 15 minutes, but then they had all these conversations. Like, you made that, like, because of the thing you've created, right? That thing, that living thing, seat, is what created that reaction in somebody else. And that's absolutely what we want art to do. So that's, yeah, I would say you definitely are an artist.
Thank you.
That's so important. And so much, clearly, so much shaping and thought goes into it. So speaking of that, one of the things I'd love to hear you talk about is, like, what is Seif not? You know, like, what are the mischaracterizations sometimes you hear about Seif and that you'd like to kind of tamp down?
That Seif is just a party, you know, that it's like everything that we have there, even the really fun, silly things, are all about creating connection, and that they're all about creating community and giving people a chance to feel safe to express themselves. Like, I would really, we have performances that are very integrated into the space, to where sometimes you're like, is that a performance? I'm not sure. And that's great, because I want people to go, well, if it's not a performance, that means somebody just showed up in that outfit and started doing those weird things that are really cool to look at.
Yeah.
Well, why can't I do that? Well, you can. As long as you're not in the way of my, you know, my staff or my performers or anything like that, do it. I would love it if somebody, like, you know, stood in the middle of the floor and started singing. Why not? Be great. You know, just don't do it while somebody's doing a lecture, or do it on the other side of the hall.
That's really interesting. So even the boundaries of what is art, what is audience versus what is art or fluid there.
Yeah, one of my one of the people that's on my steering committee has been really pushing for the past year that they've been that they've taken this position, where they are very interested on really making sure that it really feels like an immersive experience. So, like, they've taken on our lighting, and they're working closely with our different performance curators to make sure that we're creating this space where it's just magical and comes alive, the whole thing, so that you just being in there, you're part of the experience, and it gives you that encouragement. But on the same time, I really want to make sure that people feel comfortable just observing, because observation is a valid form of participation, because for every exhibitionist, you have to have a voyeur. For every performer, you need to have an audience. So it's like, while we definitely, Seif is not one of those places to, you know, to come at and be walled up. Like, it's not a place to go where you don't want to engage at all, because even to be a fully engaged observer, you still have to be engaged to really be able to make it a juicy experience for everybody.
Yeah.
And so it's not a place where you can just go and have your walls up and not, you're not going to have a good time if you're constantly on guard for anything that might come near you, or if you don't want to be too close to the art, or you don't want to engage too much with it. You have to have a sense of curiosity about it. So it can be a really difficult thing for somebody who's really not open to different ways of seeing things.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that I can say from, you know, observing people at CIF over the years when I've been there, that, like, you know, because, you know, as you were saying before, there's a certain vulnerability, right, to even allowing yourself to be drawn towards something that you might not feel like is your thing or something, but finding it compelling somehow. And you know, and I've noticed that when people go, like, in groups of friends, they're much, much more cautious than, like, when I see people who kind of are walking through alone, and they just stop at whatever, and they're just kind of having their experience. And it's really interesting to kind of see those different kinds of journeys people go on, and how they're applying their filters or other people's filters, or how this person sees them and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. So funny that you should say that, because so our art gallery is in Pioneer Square. And so before the pandemic, when there would be groups of people walking past to go to the stadiums, mm-hmm. so you'd get a group of like 5 to 6 people, you know, 4 to 6 people in there. And like always there would be, and so we have our very cute, silly erotic art in the front window to grab people's attention and not be too scary. Okay. You know, like we have these little 3D printed, they're called Dickosaurus Rex. And so it's like a little penis with like little arms and a Tyrannosaurus body, but you know, it's a penis. Yeah. and people love looking at those, and it grabs people's attention. And once they look at that, then they look up and they see like some of the other art in there, which is, you know, like right now we have a, it's Celebration of the Masculine. So it's all male bodied or masculine, people.
Okay.
Mostly figurative.
Okay.
And, you know, and then the next show that's coming up, that opens up on First Thursday, which is just coming up, in a couple of days, it's called The Bonds of Love. And so for the next 2 months, we'll have, mostly bondage inspired, art, although there are definitely a few pieces that are like, that counts as the bonds of love, but there's no bondage in there anywhere. So hopefully people will see the through line and not think it's odd. Yeah. I think it all fits. but you know, so it's like, so they always see something that's not silly, that's not funny. Uh-huh. And then there's always one person who looks like they want to come inside. And then there's another person who's like, ah, that's gross. And then like most everybody is like, oh yeah, of course we won't go in there. And one person will go along with them and, you know, still looking as long as they can, but still be part of the group. So it's fascinating dynamic, the way that works in watching that.
That's really interesting. Like, would you recommend, I mean, given all that, like, you know, like, how would you recommend, like, people take their journey through the show?
Ooh, I do think going with your friends is a good idea. And I think going with the friends that you feel safe having unpopular opinions with are the people that you want to go with. So that you can go, you know, because I have friends who are like, I don't approve of that. I know you like it. Just don't die. And I don't want to hear about it. But have fun.
Right.
Like, those are the friends that you want to go with, the ones that you can have the differing opinions and they still love you. And I would say the way we usually have it set up is that we try to set it up even before the pandemic. We try to set up so that there's like a flow of which way you go to look at the art.
Okay.
And so like usually the art that's very sweet or very lighthearted, humorous, we try to put towards the front.
Okay.
Because that's like, that's not as hard to look at. You know, we save the things that are more like, kink oriented or things that have sadomasochism in them. Mm-hmm. Or things that talk that maybe talk about, surviving abuse. Mm-hmm. We try to put a little bit farther in the space so that you can kind of work up into the intensity a little bit, so that we're not just hitting you with, you know, here's a super intense scene and you can't tell, is this something that they wanted or something that they didn't?
Right.
And we actually spend a fair amount of time with the visual art to set it up as kind of like, not really a narrative, but kind of like a, and here's the part where we get to show you the paintings that are, that start out realistic and get more and more abstract. Mm-hmm. And here's where we put all the stuff that seems like, we put all the snakes, we put all the blood, we put that in one area so people can go, and there's a snake in there, I just won't go in there.
Right.
That is the thing people have the most problem with, by the way.
Yeah, snakes.
Never put the snake pictures close to the bathroom, because there will be some people who just literally cannot walk by them and go to the bathroom. That's just rude. Don't make life hard for people.
Interesting.
Yeah, snakes are like the biggest, scariest ones. Snakes and blood.
Interesting.
Very reasonable concerns and fears.
So one question I have that out of personal interest is like, I was thrilled to see there's a literary category in SIEF, and I'd love to understand more about how does that work at the show? Like, are there readings?
So we do. We have readings, and we're very excited is that I have convinced them that they do not need to be in the small little room off to the side, that they should be on the main stage, which I've been kind of, it's interesting because a lot of people have been like, no, the main stage is too scary. And I'm like, but your art, how am I supposed to show off your art? So we have what we call the literary lair, and that's where we have like book signings. That's when we, like on Friday night, we will have a couple of hours that are devoted, or I think on either side of the readings that happen on the stage, we do like, I think it's like a half hour or 40 minutes on either side, where you can go meet the people who are the literary artists that we publish. We make an anthology every year. It's an actual printed book. So everybody who gets a piece in the anthology, they get a copy of it, and then we sell them in the store. Awesome. And so having a meet and greet for the art writers and poets to meet each other, and also for people to go and get their books signed, is a, what I think is a really important thing. But I grew up with books, so of course I want my book to be signed every year.
That's wonderful. I love that. I love the inclusiveness of bringing, you know, that into, because sometimes, you know, literature can just be like the quiet stepchild, you know, of
right.
art, where it's like, oh, that just stays in the library or in the bookstore, you know, it doesn't really come out to play in the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's really difficult, because there are a lot of people who are, they're writers, they're not spoken word artists. There's a difference. The performance aspect is a whole nother breed of art, I think, that happens. It can be both literature and a spoken word performance if the right person doesn't.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to get our people up on the stage who want to. One of the things that we've done in the past that we may or may not resurrect because of the pandemic is that we have an old fashioned telephone that we have hooked up with an iPod so that we can have recordings of the writings that were accepted into the anthology for the people who can't show up and do a reading. Mm-hmm. So that you can just sit down and pick up the phone and it's on a loop. It just plays continuously.
Oh, I love that. That's delightful.
I'm like, but it's one of those things where it's like, we'd have to get a volunteer whose whole job was to clean it all the time.
Yeah.
So we might not do that this year. And then another thing that this year that we started this last year, and it worked really well in 2021, is where any artist who is in the anthology, if they have a book that they want to sell and they want to do like a book signing, we'll do the book signings and carry them in the store. So it's, that was a really cool thing. So just saying,
that's good to know. I mean,
we want to support our writers, because that's the really difficult thing about that one, is that it's, yay, you're published, and yay, you got a free book, and yay, you get to pay only it's like $9, like basically whatever our cost is what the writers get to buy as many copies as they want it costs, and then they can turn around and sell them. But being in the anthology is not a moneymaker, but we still need to support all of our artists.
Yeah.
in any way we can. So I really want to like really make sure that there's a place for that to happen. And so that's what happens in the literary layer, is that awesome. We give a space. And then we have a big book that we've been working on for since 2018, maybe 2017. And it's a large format blank book. And we put it out on an old fashioned writing desk and let people just write whatever they want to in there. Wow. And so you can go and you can read it. You can read what people have written in the past, or you can put something down for yourself.
A guest book, or is this for the artist or for the?
This is for everybody who wants to do. So most of the time people write in it. Occasionally there are some sketches on some of the pages. Oh, nice. Some of them are just like, I love Steve. And other things are like a poem that somebody just put in there and left in there. One time we found a whole bunch of like, somebody had a pad of post-it notes, and we found like 6 post-it notes that were like full on fleshed out ink pen drawings that were kind of tucked in there. So they're just a delight. I mean, I have one in my desk and other people have framed them. We have no idea who the artist is, but they were loose. And so we were like, they're just going to fall out. Somebody's got to enjoy this. And so that's really a neat thing to connect with, is to be able to see what people have written before. And on some of the pages, it looks like multiple people have like added to things. Like you can tell by the handwriting that it's different. But they just keep people building off of what the last person wrote. Mm-hmm. So those are the ways that we incorporate the literary arts into the art festival at the venue itself.
That's wonderful. It's very exciting. Makes me even more excited to submit. So last question, this has been really a wonderful conversation. So last question, as the director, what are you most excited about for CEF this year?
I'm excited for the, to one, be back on our regular schedule. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, I really feel like CEF is my baby. Like I've been volunteering since the third one. And I took on the taking care of the visual art in 2011. And then in 2013, I became the director. And I just feel so strongly that it just needs to exist for our artists. And the way that I've developed relationships with different artists over the years, where they feel like they have a home at CEF, because this is the place where they don't have to worry about if their art is going to fit a certain idea. Mm-hmm. There's one artist that I'm super excited about. They're one of my favorite artists right now. And I know I'm not supposed to have favorites, and I know I'm supposed to love all my children equally. And I'm just so excited about Ray Aquino. And they are, have you heard of this artist or seen their work at all?
No.
Okay. I highly recommend it. You can find them, Ray, RAE_Aquino, AKINO on Instagram.
Okay.
Absolutely amazing artist. And right now we have part one of their show called Zaddi. And that's XADDI. And it is, an exploration of, non-binary, and that balance and intertwined of masculine and feminine energy blending together to become something new.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
And they're done with portraits, and portraits are tricky. Portraits are not always art. But the way Ray has done these portraits, and the texture of the back and the patterns of the backgrounds. And so like each one, the 5 that we have in the gallery right now, there are 5 different colors, and each one also has a different pattern to the background. And some of the patterns have been based on different regions of Africa, or one was a different, one of the Caribbean islands region, like had reminiscence of patterns from that area. And so very much reaching into the African diaspora in it, as creating the context for this powerful blending of masculine and feminine to be into this new, this new thing. It's like that, it's not a balance of the binary. It's a synergy into something new.
That's incredible. Yeah. That sounds really amazing.
Yeah. And also Ray, one of the first things that caught me about Ray's work is that, when I first saw it, I think it was 2019. They were very much like, I can't tell what gender anyone in their pieces are. Mm-hmm. And there was this amazing picture where it was just a person whose hands were bent over. So it was just their ass with their fingers holding their butt cheeks open. But the way the lighting was set up, you couldn't see anything because there was just darkness. Mm-hmm. There was shadow in between the cheeks. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it was just like, who is this? And it was also, it wasn't vulnerable seeming at all. So it was very fascinating that it was a, you know, like a very femme, like porn pose, but yet because of the lack of vulnerability, you wanted to say that it was a masculine ass. And you're like, actually, you know, the way the shadows are, you can't tell if those hips are narrower, you know, like you don't know what the sex of this person is, let alone their gender.
Right.
And so I asked Ray about that. And Ray was like, yeah, you're not supposed to know. You're supposed to see yourself. Like, I make it so that when you look at a piece of art, it's you, you can put yourself in there. And, you know, and then that was like, I mean, I don't know. I haven't asked Ray this specifically, but that was like one of the beginnings of them like playing with this non-binary idea in their art, where they really started really developing that and making it much more specific. Like one of the pieces in Zadi is of a very masculine person, like, you know, with their arms folded and crossed over, and they've got a whole bunch of necklaces fabric around their neck that it's very masculine appearing, and then just a little bit underneath you can see the binder coming out from one of their arms. And it's just those little tiny things where you're like, you know, just like boom, wow. Right. And to see that represented in art so subtly and so, you know, almost kind of like it's a little nod of like, yep, this is you. You can see yourself here.
That's incredible. Yeah. Well, we'll definitely have links to Ray's work
for
this episode, as well as the links to the show and other kinds of things. Thank you so much, Sophia. This has been an incredible conversation. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to have conversations with you. You're a fantastic interviewer. I've just greatly enjoyed chatting with you.
And I'm very much looking forward to going to CIF and submitting to CIF this year as well.
Yay!
Thanks, everyone, and we will see you again next time.